Roxo Media House.
Jake, let's talk about Oscar's Pub for a second. The home base for so many good people on the west side of Fort Worth, the birthplace of the Signal 51 Chronicles. Wasn't far from where we're sitting that Jake and I made our vows. Wait, where we fashioned the idea of what would become the Signal 51 Chronicles. And it's here, Jake, at Oscar's Pub, that you can drink the tastiest beverages with the friendliest people. Be nice or go home. That's the motto of Oscar's Pub. And that is Oscar's Pub, a true friend to the Signal 51 Chronicles.
Located at 6323 Camp Bowie.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation. A law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. Episode 13 of the Signal 51 Chronicles, Vanished in Broad Daylight. On January 30th, 2004, Laura Lee Crane, a notable local educator, director of the Star Point School, a school for learning disabilities on the campus of Texas Christian University, left her home on Bel Air Drive in West Fort Worth in the late morning hours. Driving her 1999 Nissan Sentra, Crane first stopped at a friend's home before heading to a local grocery store to do routine shopping off a list formed over the past several days. A short time after leaving her friend's home, she pulled into a parking space at Tom Thumb, the chain grocery store located on 3050 Hewland Street. The store is in a prime location, located in an affluent area of Fort Worth with lots of traffic and easy access. It is only a short distance from TCU, and even closer to the home of Nikki Blahitka. Closer still, not even a quarter mile away, is the notorious Cullen Davis Mansion, site of a double murder in 1976 that touched off a series of sensational trials all over Texas. It had only been in the last 35 or 40 years that developers got their hands on what was once ranchland as far as the eye could see. The Trinity River, its companion, very casually meandering nearby. Like any Friday morning at this Tom Thumb, the lot was packed full of cars. Undoubtedly adding to the congestion this particular day were neighbors doing their shopping for Sunday's Super Bowl party. The New England Patriots and Carolina Panthers were meeting in Super Bowl 38. The store is sandwiched between various retail locations and restaurants and your typical American strip shopping center. Crane's husband expected her to return home by 1 o'clock that afternoon. When she didn't return home by 4, family members began to worry and called the Fort Worth police to report her missing. After receiving the call, police opened a Signal 51 investigation. Crane stopped by her friend's house, they knew that, and had planned to go to Tom Thumb. No one knew if she actually made it there.
When officers arrived, they spoke with Laura Crane's husband. He had done a little bit of research to maybe find out her whereabouts, and he shared with the police that 3 of Laura Crane's credit cards had been used to withdraw over $600 in cash. Crane's husband described these cash withdrawals as uncharacteristic. Crane's husband also told responding officers that if Crane was running late, it was normal for her to call, something she had not done and something that had worried him. The responding patrol officers requested a missing persons detective respond to the scene. Upon arrival, the missing persons detective interviewed the family, who told police Laura did not have any medical or mental problems. She also had no prior episodes of unexplained disappearances. Detectives checked all the local hospitals and the medical examiner's office. Laura Crane was not there either. Next, detectives contacted Laura's bank and spoke with a fraud investigator who said that on January 30th, from 12:57 p.m. to 3:08 p.m., Laura's credit cards were used 9 times at various locations in Fort Worth. While the behind-the-scenes investigation was underway, police launched a search. Now keep in mind, this is 2004. The search for a missing person was a bit more difficult. There was no technology that could track people like we have today. We had no license plate reader cameras, no cell phone tracking mechanisms, or even social media for that matter. Oftentimes, it was getting word out that the person was missing, and cops and volunteers searching the quote-unquote back alleys. That's what happened in this case. There was some frustration for the search party, a fact we'll discuss later, but it centered on information not being disseminated quickly enough. The search, though, for the most part, was confined only to areas around where Crane was missing from and her home. The search party looking for Laura Lee Crane was large, but it yielded nothing. The retired educator had disappeared in plain sight. One possible lead popped up in the late evening hours on January 30th. A Fort Worth police sergeant on routine patrol spotted a vehicle at East Vickery and Thrall in East Fort Worth. The vehicle matched the description of Crane's vehicle. The first three license plate characters were the same. The driver and officer made eye contact. However, the car fled and ultimately eluded the sergeant.
An aside to this story was a contentious political issue coinciding with the disappearance. 18 months prior, the Fort Worth Housing Authority purchased the Stonegate Villa Apartments with designs on relocating residents of the Ripley Arnold housing complex. Opponents of the plan were concerned that a criminal element might also move in. No one wanted to admit it, and they still don't, but racial overtones were obvious in the opposition. The Stonegate Villas were located less than a mile away from this Tom Thumb. Since its construction 10 or so years before, it was TCU students and young professionals who called the Stonegate Villas home. The multifamily complex also backs up to Colonial Country Club. When the Fort Worth Housing Authority purchased the 550-plus unit complex for $31 million, according to news reports, their plan was to set aside 20% of the units for low-income housing. Again, at the center of the opposition was concern about crime. Fears were abundant about sex offenders and light criminal element moving into this mostly affluent area. While this was not likely the only reason cops confined their search, rest assured, it was on the minds of the cops and residents in the area. Now, Jake, age also played a role, at least initially in this investigation, right? That's something you noticed.
It did. So the age of a missing person matters because it can guide the search efforts. In this case, Laura was 79 years old. She had no known medical conditions that would have suggested she had become confused and lost. But often, when an elderly person is reported missing, it's not uncommon for police to think she's just that, lost, not abducted. Again, we're talking about the likelihood of a kidnapping at a busy intersection, in a busy part of town, in an affluent part of town. It really does not happen, at least most of the time. So what I found interesting, the responding officer was concerned enough that foul play was suspected, so much so that he called detectives. Not something that happens often. This was a quick decision, and his concern was possibly justified.
Let me ask you this right quick. So is that a decision an officer makes, or does he go to his boss, and that boss recommends, yeah, call detectives?
Yeah, they're going to call, like in this case, the officer can make the decision. He's going to notify his supervisor. I think that in the reports that we read and the information, the documents that we obtained in this case, that concern came to the surface quickly. The officer was an experienced officer. Ultimately, it didn't make sense. Crane's husband explained in detail kind of her habits, and that, you know, like we touched on earlier, even if she was going to be late, she would call. The credit card usage, I think, was probably the biggest concern. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, if you lose your credit cards, if somebody steals your purse, sure, they're going to be used, you know, all over the city or all over the county, whatever the case may be, or even today, God knows where, with online. But with this one, the credit cards were being used. She was at least 3 hours late. And of most concern, nobody had a clue where she was.
All right. Well, I took you off on a detour there. Carry on.
All right. So the search continued. And these searches are frustrating. You're looking for a needle in a haystack. You have nowhere to go. And in 2004, like we touched on, honestly, you have to get lucky. You have to have the astute cop or the astute driver on the road that sees a car and then calls the police. You literally had to stumble upon the person in order to find them.
Be an accident more than anything.
Almost an accident, exactly. So 2 days later, though, on February 1st, 2004, at 1:02 a.m., an Oklahoma City police officer by the name of Jeff Padgett located a car driving erratically in a hotel parking lot in northeast Oklahoma City. After the car failed to use a turn signal, Officer Padgett initiated a traffic stop. As Officer Padgett approached, a dispatcher got on the radio and stated the car registered to a missing person from Fort Worth who was possibly in danger.
Okay, so Officer Padgett pulls over this car. He knows it could be possibly connected to a serious crime. What goes through the mind of an officer when he approaches that car with that knowledge?
So it depends on the details. It depends on the cop. Depends on the circumstances as a whole. There's a couple ways you could, the responding officer, or in this case, the officer who initiated the traffic stop could approach that scenario. But in this case, Officer Padgett seemingly goes with the, I'm just going to play this off routine. And he asked the driver if he had anything illegal on him.
All right. Well, that seems like a pretty logical question an officer might ask a driver.
Very, especially in these, you know, no-tell, motel type places in a high crime area, and also even more common in the middle of the night.
So I'm as a civilian here, I'm trying to picture myself in the officer's shoes. I'm aware this car could be linked, and the people in it, obviously, could be linked to a very serious crime. I'm thinking that my reaction would be probably different. Like I, you know, might've pulled my gun or something similar.
So two things to look at. Padgett stops his car because it didn't use its turn signal. I didn't speak to Officer Padgett on this. I'm going to suggest that he was more than likely at the motel looking for something more, not looking for Laura Lee Crane's vehicle. But in these locations, in the wee hours of the morning, bad things happen.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that the motels in Oklahoma City, a relatively large city in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
have the exact same problems that we have here in Fort Worth, Texas. It's going to run from your fugitives to your drug dealers to your prostitution, and the list goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So Padgett, albeit had a trivial reason to stop this car, things changed quickly for him. And he had to make a split-second decision. Then problems can arise if you don't play it off. Mm-hmm. Again, you got to realize he pulls his car over. I can almost guarantee you he thinks, hey, I'm going to get some dope out of this car, or I'm going to get a felony warrant out of this car, or something to that effect. And as he's walking up, the dispatcher gets on and says, hey, whatever his unit number is, that car registers to a missing person who's possibly in danger out of Texas or whatever the details were that were conveyed to Padgett. But one of the things he had to do was make that split second decision. He had to play it off. So one of the tools the cops have when it comes to investigations is they can lie. Not lying to create evidence or change the facts, but lying to diffuse, or even the new hot button term, de-escalate. And in this case, Officer Padgett seemingly went with the route of, hey, I'm just going to play this off. I'm probably going to wait for my backup to get here. I don't want to spook these people. Mainly, though, and likely why he did that. The last thing that Officer Padgett wanted to do was become involved in a car chase with this vehicle.
Why is that?
So in this case, the car we're talking about is Laura Lee Crane's car. If Laura Lee Crane is being held against her will or tied up in the trunk, You cannot risk the suspect getting away or the suspect crashing in a high-speed chase. If the vehicle occupants escape and escape for good, you have nobody to ask any further questions. And remember, this is 180 miles north of Fort Worth. Paget, he has no idea who Laura Lee Crane is or even the facts surrounding her disappearance. So on this traffic stop, the driver said he didn't have a problem with officers searching his car and informed Paget they were in Oklahoma City for vacation and that he was from Fort Worth. More than likely, the driver of the car steps out. Officer Paget asked him if he could pat him down for any weapons. The driver in this case replied, quote, sure. The pat-down was conducted, and the driver was placed in handcuffs and secured in the backseat of a patrol vehicle. Again, this is going a little bit farther. There was a little more to this story, right? We talk about the idea of it being, you know, in a high-crime area, possibly leaving a motel in the middle of the night or at 1:02 a.m., but even more so now, he's driving a car that registers to a missing person who another police agency says, hey, this person may be in danger. So he's got to get to the bottom of it and figure out what's going on. Because if the driver in this case takes off running, gets away, they have nobody. They have no other leads at that point. So backup officers arrive and they go back up to the car and there's a female in the front passenger seat. So officers ask the female front passenger if she had anything illegal on her. She replied she had a crack pipe in her purse. Again, a very common response on a traffic stop, leaving a low-budget motel in the middle of the night.
So, obviously, Officer Paget and now the other officers who've joined him are not surprised by that response. But why would she admit to it? Should be, you know, without a search or anything like that.
So 2004 and before and a little bit after, people, at least in Fort Worth, keep in mind the driver said he was from Fort Worth. We don't know about the female yet. They don't fear the consequences of a drug paraphernalia charge. It's a ticket. It's just like getting a traffic ticket. Mm-hmm. There's the consequence is not that severe. So she admits to having it in her purse. She confesses to a crime, if you will, albeit a minor crime. So officers now search the car, look in the purse, and they find her crack cocaine pipe. They don't stop there, though. Next up, now knowing this was no ordinary traffic stop, Oklahoma City officers asked if they could search the room, which was room 11 of a Relax Inn motel. It's the same room the driver and the passenger were occupying.
And obviously, officers were hoping to find something in that room.
They were. In this case, I think they were hoping to find Laura Lee Crane. When officers searched the room, unfortunately, they did not find Laura. But they did find items they believed to be indicators of people attempting to change their appearance. The items were clothes and hair dye in a trash can. The driver, Edward Busby, was placed under arrest for traffic infractions, and the passenger, Kathleen Latimer, was placed under arrest for a crack pipe containing residue. There's a few other things, though, to unpack with this traffic stop. Again, first, was Paget really just pulling a car over for not using a turn signal? Like we talked about, no. He was looking for something more. I can only imagine that some of our listeners have driven by those low-budget motels, seen the things there and wonder what really goes on there.
I'm one of them who does that.
Whatever you're thinking, it happens. And it probably happens at a level that most people can't comprehend. They are literally dens, crime dens, if you will. You know, a drug dealer in room 12, four prostitutes in room 13.
Right.
A guy buying and selling stolen property in room 14, and the list goes on.
Things that don't happen in my snow globe.
They don't happen in I hope they don't happen in your snow globe.
My little bubble. No.
No. So, again, I can almost guarantee Paget, he was at this hotel looking for the criminal element. He wasn't necessarily looking for Busby or Latimer, but the criminal element that is oh so often associated with this type of location.
Officer Paget's response to the car and the subsequent questions and all this stuff, he wants to see the room and all this stuff, Is there an academy class that takes officers through these types of scenarios where how to handle this situation where a cop approaches a car? In this instance, he decides he's going to do the plate off routine rather than something else, which might, you know, cause an escape. Do cops go through these scenarios?
Not.
Or is it just experience that?
Not exactly formalized training. It does. It comes down to the experience. It really comes down to the motivation of what the officer wanted to do. I mean, or what the officer does on a daily basis. Again, Padgett, I mean, truth be told, at 1 o'clock in the morning, the amount of people calling the police is a little bit less. I mean, the calls aren't rolling in just constantly. There's a lot of downtime, if you will. So those midnight patrol officers, those cops who work the overnight shift, historically, and it may have changed, but historically have always been the ones that are going to look for the criminal element. And just getting a kind of an overview of this case, Padgett, he seems like one of those motivated cops. He was honestly looking for a criminal in whatever shape or form that comes in. And so I think his quick response, because again, you're talking seconds from him pulling the car over, walking up to the car. As he's walking up to the car, hey, this car belongs to a missing person who's possibly in danger in Fort Worth. He's got to make a decision and got to make it quickly. I mean, he's not going to retreat, but he responds with a way to, and perhaps he saw a bigger picture with this. I mean, there is that possibility. You know, if he's developing that rapport, this is kind of like his response is much like a sales tactic, mm-hmm. right? And it's also loosely can be based on the same interrogation tactics, the same tactics we've talked about in other episodes, the murder of Nicole Blahitka, where we see Detective Pate kind of go through step by step, breaking that suspect down. The same thing happens here. Padgett probably saw, hey, there's obviously something way more to this story, something way bigger than what I thought. I want to see how far I can go with this, because if I can find that person that's missing, well, that's what the cops are here to do.
Kathleen Latimer, openly acknowledging that she's carrying a crack pipe, that could also have, does it go off in the cop's mind that she might be trying to distract from something else that she doesn't want them to find?
Not necessarily. I think Latimer, being from Fort Worth, for all I know, I could have had an encounter with her at some point in my career. I have no idea. Based on her criminal history and based on what I did, it's possible I never actually looked into that to see, but hearing her response, that happened all the time, almost daily. Like I said, they didn't fear the consequence of a crack pipe.
Right.
But here's what they also didn't know. That's called probable cause. So now, yes, I have a crack pipe in my purse. So maybe let me circle back to what you said. To a certain degree, yes. Because I think what some of them thought was, well, if I tell the cop that I have a crack pipe in my purse,
that's
all they're going to look. They're just going to look in my purse, and or maybe I just hand them the crack pipe and it's done. No, that's called probable cause. So now
we get the whole car.
Yeah, we get the whole car, and they're, you know, cracking the console or under the seat or whatever the case may be. So yeah, that's an interesting question, a good question, because that did happen often, and maybe that's what Latimer was thinking, because I don't want to get too far off into the details.
All right. Well, when Oklahoma City police officer Padgett encountered Edward Busby and Kathleen Latimer, it had been 2 days since the reported disappearance of Laura Lee Crane, and her car was more than 180 miles from her hometown. In part two of Vanished in Broad Daylight, Oklahoma City Police interview Edward Busby and Kathleen Latimer. Join us next week for part two.
Roxo Media House.